This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Michael Scherer. Typee by Herman Melville. Chapter 13. Amidst these novel scenes, a week passed away almost imperceptibly. The natives, actuated by some mysterious impulse, day after day redoubled their attentions to us. Their manner towards us was unaccountable. Surely, thought I, they would not act thus if they meant us any harm. But why this excess of deferential kindness, or what equivalent can they imagine us capable of rendering them for it? We were fairly puzzled. But despite the apprehensions I could not dispel, the horrible character imputed to these Typees appeared to me wholly undeserved. "Why, they are cannibals," said Toby on one occasion when I eulogized the tribe. "Granted," I replied, "but a more humane, gentlemanly, and amiable set of epicures do not probably exist in the Pacific." But notwithstanding the kind treatment we received, I was too familiar with the fickle disposition of savages not to feel anxious to withdraw from the valley and put myself beyond the reach of that fearful death which, under all these smiling appearances, might yet menace us. But here there was an obstacle in the way of doing so. It was idle for me to think of moving from the place until I should have recovered from the severe lameness that afflicted me. Indeed, my malady began seriously to alarm me, for despite the herbal remedies of the natives, it continued to grow worse and worse. Their mild applications, though they soothed the pain, did not remove the disorder, and I felt convinced that without better aid I might anticipate long and acute suffering. But how was this aid to be procured? From the surgeons of the French fleet, which probably still lay in the Bay of Nukuheva, it might easily have been obtained, could I have made my case known to them. But how could that be effected? At last, in the exigency to which I was reduced, I proposed to Toby that he should endeavor to go round to Nukuheva, and if he could not succeed in returning to the valley by water, in one of the boats of the squadron, and taking me off, he might at least procure me some proper medicines, and effect his return overland. My companion listened to me in silence, and at first did not appear to relish the idea. The truth was, he felt impatient to escape from the place, and wished to avail himself of our present high favor with the natives to make good our retreat, before we should experience some sudden alteration in their behavior. As he could not think of leaving me in my helpless condition, he implored me to be of good cheer, assured me that I should soon be better, and enabled in a few days to return with him to Nukuheva. Added to this, he could not bear the idea of again returning to this dangerous place, and as for the expectation of persuading the Frenchmen to detach a boat's crew for the purpose of rescuing me from the Typees, he looked upon it as idle, and with arguments that I could not answer, urged the improbability of their provoking the hostilities of the clan by any such measure, especially as, for the purpose of quieting its apprehensions, they had as yet refrained from making any visit to the bay.
"And even should they consent," said Toby, "they would only produce a commotion in the valley, in which we might both be sacrificed by these ferocious islanders."
This was unanswerable. But still I clung to the belief that he might succeed in accomplishing the other part of my plan, and at last I overcame his scruples, and he agreed to make the attempt. As soon as we succeeded in making the natives understand our intention, they broke out into the most vehement opposition to the measure, and for a while I almost despaired of obtaining their consent. At the bare thought of one of us leaving them, they manifested the most lively concern. The grief and consternation of Kory Kory in particular was unbounded. He threw himself into a perfect paroxysm of gestures, which were intended to convey to us not only his abhorrence of Nukuheva and its uncivilized inhabitants, but also his astonishment that after becoming acquainted with the enlightened Typees, we should evince the least desire to withdraw, even for a time, from their agreeable society. However, I overbore his objections by appealing to my lameness, from which I assured the natives I should speedily recover, if Toby were permitted to obtain the supplies I needed. It was agreed that on the following morning my companion should depart, accompanied by some one or two of the household, who should point out to him an easy route, by which the bay might be reached before sunset. At early dawn of the next day, our habitation was astir. One of the young men mounted into an adjoining coconut tree, and threw down a number of the young fruit, which old Marheyo quickly stripped of the green husks, and strung together upon a short pole. These were intended to refresh Toby on his route. The preparations being completed, with no little emotion, I bade my companion adieu. He promised to return in 3 days at farthest, and, bidding me keep up my spirits in the interval, turned round the corner of the peepee, and, under the guidance of the venerable Marheyo, was soon out of sight. His departure oppressed me with melancholy, and, re-entering the dwelling, I threw myself almost in despair upon the matting of the floor. In 2 hours' time the old warrior returned, and gave me to understand that after accompanying my companion a little distance and showing him the route, he had left him journeying on his way. It was about noon of this same day, a season which these people are wont to pass in sleep, that I lay in the house, surrounded by its slumbering inmates, and painfully affected by the strange silence which prevailed. All at once I thought I heard a faint shout, as if proceeding from some persons in the depth of the grove which extended in front of our habitation. The sounds grew louder and nearer, and gradually the whole valley rang with wild outcries. The sleepers around me started to their feet in alarm, and hurried outside to discover the cause of the commotion. Kory Kory, who had been the first to spring up, soon returned almost breathless and nearly frantic with the excitement under which he seemed to be laboring. All that I could understand from him was that some accident had happened to Toby. Apprehensive of some dreadful calamity, I rushed out of the house and caught sight of a tumultuous crowd, who, with shrieks and lamentations, were just emerging from the grove, bearing in their arms some object, the sight of which produced all this transport of sorrow. As they drew near, the men redoubled their cries, while the girls, tossing their bare arms in the air, exclaimed plaintively, "Aha! Aha! Toby Muki Moi!" Alas, alas, Toby is killed. In a moment, the crowd opened, and disclosed the apparently lifeless body of my companion borne between two men, the head hanging heavily against the breast of the foremost. The whole face, neck, and bosom were covered with blood, which still trickled slowly from a wound behind the temple. In the midst of the greatest uproar and confusion, the body was carried into the house and laid on a mat. Waving the natives off to give room and air, I bent eagerly over Toby, and laying my hand upon the breast, ascertained that the heart still beat. Overjoyed at this, I seized a calabash of water and dashed its contents upon his face. Then, wiping away the blood, anxiously examined the wound. It was about 3 inches long, and on removing the clotted hair from about it, showed the skull laid completely bare. Immediately with my knife I cut away the heavy locks, and bathed the part repeatedly in water. In a few moments Toby revived, and opening his eyes for a second, closed them again without speaking. Kory Kory, who had been kneeling beside me, now chafed his limbs gently with the palms of his hands, while a young girl at his head kept fanning him, and I still continued to moisten his lips and brow. Soon my poor comrade showed signs of animation, and I succeeded in making him swallow from a coconut shell a few mouthfuls of water. Old Tinor now appeared, holding in her hand some simples she had gathered, the juice of which she by signs besought me to squeeze into the wound. Having done so, I thought it best to leave Toby undisturbed until he should have had time to rally his faculties. Several times he opened his lips, but fearful for his safety, I enjoined silence. In the course of 2 or 3 hours, however, he sat up, and was sufficiently recovered to tell me what had occurred.
"After leaving the house with Marheyo," said Toby, "we struck across the valley and ascended the opposite heights. Just beyond them, my guide informed me, lay the valley of Happar, while along their summits and skirting the head of the vale was my route to Nukuheva. After mounting a little way up the elevation, my guide paused and gave me to understand that he could not accompany me any farther, and by various signs intimated that he was afraid to approach any nearer the territories of the enemies of his tribe. He, however, pointed out my path, which now lay clearly before me, and bidding me farewell, hastily descended the mountain. Quite elated at being so near the Happars, I pushed up the acclivity, and soon gained its summit. It tapered up to a sharp ridge, from whence I beheld both the hostile valleys. Here I sat down and rested for a moment, refreshing myself with my coconuts. I was soon again pursuing my way along the height, when suddenly I saw three of the islanders, who must have just come out of Happar Valley, standing in the path ahead of me. They were each armed with a heavy spear, and one from his appearance I took to be a chief. They sung out something, I could not understand what, and beckoned me to come on. Without the least hesitation I advanced towards them, and had approached within about a yard of the foremost, when pointing angrily into the Typee Valley, and uttering some savage exclamation, he wheeled round his weapon like lightning, and struck me in a moment to the ground. The blow inflicted this wound, and took away my senses. As soon as I came to myself, I perceived the three islanders standing a little distance off, and apparently engaged in some violent altercation respecting me. My first impulse was to run for it, but in endeavoring to rise, I fell back, and rolled down a little grassy precipice. The shock seemed to rally my faculties, so starting to my feet, I fled down the path I had just ascended. I had no need to look behind me, for from the yells I heard, I knew that my enemies were in full pursuit. Urged on by their fearful outcries, and heedless of the injury I had received, though the blood flowing from the wound trickled over into my eyes and almost blinded me, I rushed down the mountainside with the speed of the wind. In a short time I had descended nearly a third of the distance, and the savages had ceased their cries, when suddenly a terrific howl burst upon my ear, and at the same moment a heavy javelin darted past me as I fled, and stuck quivering in a tree close to me. Another yell followed, and a second spear and a third shot through the air within a few feet of my body, both of them piercing the ground obliquely in advance of me. The fellows gave a roar of rage and disappointment, but they were afraid, I suppose, of coming down further into the Typee Valley, and so abandoned the chase. I saw them recover their weapons and turn back, and I continued my descent as fast as I could. What could have caused this ferocious attack on the part of these Happars I could not imagine, unless it were that they had seen me ascending the mountain with Marheyo, and that the mere fact of coming from the Typee Valley was sufficient to provoke them. As long as I was in danger, I scarcely felt the wound I had received, but when the chase was over, I began to suffer from it. I had lost my hat in my flight, and the sun scorched my bare head. I felt faint and giddy, but fearful of falling to the ground beyond the reach of assistance, I staggered on as well as I could, and at last gained the level of the valley. And then down I sunk, and I knew nothing more until I found myself lying upon these mats, and you stooping over me with a calabash of water. Such was Toby's account of this sad affair. I afterwards learned that fortunately he had fallen close to a spot where the natives go for fuel. A party of them caught sight of him as he fell, and sounding the alarm, had lifted him up, and after ineffectually endeavoring to restore him at the brook, had hurried forward with him to the house. This incident threw a dark cloud over our prospects. It reminded us that we were hemmed in by hostile tribes, whose territories we could not hope to pass, on our route to Nukuheva, without encountering the effects of their savage resentment. There appeared to be no avenue opened to our escape but the sea, which washed the lower extremity of the vale. Our Typee friends availed themselves of the recent disaster of Toby to exhort us to a due appreciation of the blessings we enjoyed among them, contrasting their own generous reception of us with the animosity of their neighbors. They likewise dwelt upon the cannibal propensities of the Happars, a subject which they were perfectly aware could not fail to alarm us, while at the same time they earnestly disclaimed all participation in so horrid a custom. Nor did they omit to call upon us to admire the natural loveliness of their own abode, and the lavish abundance with which it produced all manner of luxuriant fruits, exalting it in this particular above any of the surrounding valleys.
Kori Kori seemed to experience so heartfelt a desire to infuse into our minds proper views on these subjects, that, assisted in his endeavors by the little knowledge of the language we had acquired, he actually succeeded in making us comprehend a considerable part of what he said. To facilitate our correct apprehension of his meaning, he at first condensed his ideas into the smallest possible compass.
"Hepar kiki no nui," he exclaimed. "Nui nui kiki kanaka. Ah, aule motarki,"
which signifies, "Terrible fellows, those Hepars, devour an amazing quantity of men. Ah, shocking bad." Thus far he explained himself by a variety of gestures, during the performance of which he would dart out of the house and point abhorrently towards the Hepar Valley, running in to us again with a rapidity that showed he was fearful we would lose one part of his meaning before he could complete the other, and continuing his illustrations by seizing the fleshy part of my arm in his teeth, intimating by the operation that the people who lived over in that direction would like nothing better than to treat me in that manner. Having assured himself that we were fully enlightened on this point, he proceeded to another branch of his subject.
"Ah, taipi motarki, nui nui miori, nui nui wai, nui nui poi poi, nui nui koku, ah nui nui kiki, ah nui nui nui,"
which, liberally interpreted as before, would imply, "Ah, taipi, isn't it a fine place, though? No danger of starving here, I tell you. Plenty of breadfruit, plenty of water, plenty of pudding. Ah, plenty of everything. Ah, heaps, heaps, heaps." All this was accompanied by a running commentary of signs and gestures which it was impossible not to comprehend. As he continued his harangue, however, Kori Kori, in emulation of our more polished orators, began to launch out rather diffusely into other branches of his subject, enlarging probably upon the moral reflections it suggested, and proceeded in such a strain of unintelligible and stunning gibberish that he actually gave me the headache for the rest of the day.